Hey everyone, this is Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week, the podcast is supported by Nukeproof and Layat. You'll all know Nukeproof from watching Sam Hill absolutely slaying the Enduro World Series on their bikes, but they also have a massive range of other components too. I've got their bars, stem, pedals, headset and bottom bracket on my new bike and it's all top quality stuff. I'm particularly impressed by their Horizon V2 carbon bars, which are a really nice shape and they're not too stiff. They've also changed the way that the back sweep is added so that when you change the roll of the bar, you don't lose loads of reach at the same time, so it's a pretty smart piece of kit. You can check out everything they have to offer over at nukeproof.com, and for you Downtime listeners, Nukeproof are giving away a set of their new Horizon wheels worth £400 in whatever size you need for your bike. To be in with a chance of winning, all you need to do is to head over to downtimepodcast.com/nukeproof and answer the ridiculously easy question before the end of July. This episode is also supported by Layat. Layat are a head-to-toe company and provide everything from helmets and braces through protection and apparel to riding shoes. I've been riding in some of their kit over the last few weeks and I've been really impressed. Last week I mentioned the Airflex Pro knee guards, which are definitely the most comfortable knee pad I've ever ridden, and this week I want to mention their DBX4 shorts. They're a tough short for gravity kind of riding, but they have a four-way stretch fabric panels in them, so they're super comfortable and they're not stiff like some of the tougher shorts can be. They're also not that heavy and breathe pretty well. The cut's really good, fits nicely over knee pads and doesn't leave any kind of gap. You can check out everything Layat has to offer over at layat.com. That's L-E-A-T-T.com. If you want to be in with a chance of winning a pair of their new Aaron Chase signature shoes, then all you need to do is to head to layat.com/AC shoe and fill in your email address there. You've got until the end of July to get that done to be in with a chance to win. All the links you need are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Thanks to everyone who's bought one of my new t-shirts. I really appreciate it. If you want to help support the podcast too, then head over to my web store now and check out the new range. They're all made of a super soft 100% organic cotton with a really great fit, and they're made using renewable energy too. So if you want to look great and help the podcast at the same time, then you can do that by heading to downtimepodcast.com/shop now. If you're not yet subscribed to the podcast, then you really should. That way, you'll never miss an episode. It's free. It's super easy to do. Just head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and click the button for whichever platform is best for you. While you're there, you can also fill in a form to join our newsletter. I'll send you some exciting stuff from the world of mountain biking every week, along with any information on things like competitions and giveaways that we've got running. All right, this week, I'm joined by one of the fastest enduro riders on the planet, Robin Warner. Robin has had a long career in mountain biking, coming from a downhill background, but more recently moved over into the Enduro World Series. We chat about his career so far and his time as both a privateer and running his own team. We talk about what drove the change from downhill to enduro. We chat a bit about learning stages, bike setup, and what impact being a dad has had on his racing. So without further ado, here's Robin Warner. Robin Warner, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's things with you?
Thank you. I'm doing really good today, actually. Yeah, just had a pretty busy week with the bike festival at home. So it's been a nice chill day at home.
Excellent. And it's been your birthday recently as well, yeah?
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
How old?
Oh, 32 years old, or 32 years young, I would say.
Excellent. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. Did you do anything special?
Not really, actually, because we had a video project last week and or a bike festival at home. So it was a pretty busy schedule, actually. The first real sort of event for the season. So I didn't really celebrate my birthday then, but then we won the video challenge on Saturday, so we had a few drinks afterwards.
Nice, congratulations.
Thank you.
I watched that. That was it's sort of part of your vlog series, is it? Had the same name.
Yeah, it's kind of a part of it, but it's like obviously nothing like the rest of the series, because we spent a lot more time and effort into making a good edit out of it. But me and Niklas talked before about, like, okay, so we haven't actually done anything in the vlog series for a while, so this has to sort of get included in it.
Fair enough. And how did the bike festival work then? Was it, I'm guessing it wasn't a bike festival as you would normally have it.
No, exactly. So the festival itself was completely digital. And at first I was like, huh, how is this going to work? But so they didn't really have any official events more than like there was a whip off, but they opened a jump that you could go and hit whenever you wanted. And then you just videoed your friend or yourself or whatever, and then sent in the video to the studio. Okay. So it was like you could win the whip off as an event, but it wasn't an event with like 50 riders and spectators. It was just you rode the jump whenever you wanted during the week. So they tried to have some events without people getting together.
Yeah.
But it's obviously really hard to sort of do something and really control what it ends up happening, but I think it worked out really well actually.
Cool. So you had a good week then.
Yeah. And then we had the video challenge, which basically worked just as normal. The big difference was that we didn't have any non-Swedish riders on site. Mm-hmm. And but other than that, I mean, we could film and do whatever we wanted pretty much as normal. So yeah, it was pretty cool to have just, I think everyone is happy for anything to happen right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Just an event is a good thing to have, yeah. Isn't it? Right now. It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah.
Cool. Nice one.
Really cool.
Good stuff. Well, let's wind the clock back a little bit then and find out a little bit from you about how you got into bikes in the first place.
Ooh. In the very beginning, I was more into motorbikes, but that was kind of a bit more complicated. I mean, my dad used to ride trials and enduro motorbikes. And me and my brother used to come and just ride around the parking lots on our scrappy BMX bikes. And that's pretty much how I got into, yeah, mountain biking, to be honest. Like I rode on my BMX, but I rode trails in the woods on my BMX okay. bike. And then we have a cousin who used to race downhill. That we went and watched. This was like 97 or something. We watched the downhill race that he did, like one of his first ones. And then we thought it was really cool. So then I started riding downhill. That's about it really.
And a bit of dual slalom racing early on as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the thing. In Sweden, you weren't allowed to, I mean, I was 10 when I did my first race, but then you weren't allowed to race downhill, so you had to race slalom, mm-hmm. which was sick. Back then, I mean, back then slalom was just as big as downhill. So that was actually really fun days of mountain biking. Yeah.
Yeah. Were you pretty good at it straight away? I think I've seen pictures of trophies for dual slalom from when you were pretty young.
Actually, like I wasn't that good like the first year I wasn't that good, but then I trained a little bit more, not serious. I mean, I was 11, so I it's not like I trained seriously for it, but just a little bit. And then I grew about 15 centimeters over one, like pretty much like one winter. And that was like made a pretty big difference to like the year after. And then, yeah, I think I progressed pretty fast at the big, like in the beginning. So yeah, I was pretty decent at it from the start.
Yeah. When you say you trained a little bit, like what sort of things do you remember doing aged 11? You weren't in the gym doing deadlifts, no?
Oh, no. I didn't, it's not like I lifted weights or anything. It was just more that from the beginning, I didn't even go to, like, we had a club, but I never went to the club training or whatever, because that was XC.
Okay.
And I was like, nah, not gonna do that. So I did that like once a week. And then I just rode more. Because I used to play hockey as well and other sports, but already, like when I was 11, 12, I got more into bikes, and then I quit playing hockey when I turned, the winter I was 13. Mm-hmm. So then I just rode bikes, really. So that was probably the main difference, the difference wasn't probably that I trained more, but it was just, I rode more.
Yeah. More time on a bike.
Yeah.
And was it always the gravity side of things then? You had no interest in cross country?
Yeah. I had no interest whatsoever in cross country. I did some cross country races, like club races, when I was maybe 13 or 14, but I absolutely hated it. And I remember I did one race in like my moto jersey and flat pedals. And I had no intention whatsoever to race XC. I wasn't interested in that.
Fair enough. That's cool. What was the scene like then in Sweden back then? Because did you grow up in Stockholm?
Yeah, I did. Oh, good research there. I did grow up in Stockholm, so we didn't really have any proper hills. Like there's tons of tiny little ski hills with the T-bar lift on it from like the 80s slalom racing, like ski slalom racing scene, and almost every single one of them ended up having like at least a downhill track for a while. Mm-hmm. So there was a really good scene, but it was like a minute long tops tracks. But it was pretty cool. And then at the end of the 90s, Sweden had a lot of good downhill races. We had like Johan Engström, who was on the Volvo Cannondale team, and that kind of helped having sort of a local scene as well when I got into it. But then in the early 2000s, it felt like it kind of died a little bit in Sweden.
Yeah.
Because all the pros quit at the same time after, I think it was like 2001, they all quit that season. And then the whole scene sort of went into some sort of sleep mode or something.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, we had a pretty good scene in Stockholm there for a while anyway. And the big difference then was we didn't have any, there wasn't any bike park. So like when I rode downhill, that was like at the races. Right. You went racing because then the lift was running somewhere. But now there's like bike parks everywhere and you can ride whenever you want. So it was kind of different, like you went racing to get to use your downhill bike kind of thing.
Yeah. And was there plenty of racing available to help you work your way up to being ready for World Cup level racing?
Definitely not for World Cup racing. There was plenty of racing, like we had a local downhill series in Stockholm, but that's like we raced on the tiny hills around Stockholm. It was a minute long tracks, and I remember going from that to just to ride in Åre was like, okay, I restart my riding process of the season kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it was still it was really enjoyable, but yeah, it didn't really help to prepare you to be World Cup downhill racer or anything.
Yeah, fair play. So when was your first World Cup downhill?
I did do 3-4 cross World Cups in 2005.
Okay. Before you raced downhill.
And then because I didn't have any UCI points, so I wasn't in some weird way, you weren't allowed to race for your national federation in downhill without UCI points, but you could race four cross.
Okay. Strange.
So I did some four cross races in 05, and then I did world junior world champs in 05. And then the year after I did pretty much all the World Cups except for Brazil as a junior.
What was it like then going from 1 minute local downhill races to doing a full season of the World Cup circuit?
It was, let's just say I learned a lot. crashed a lot. but it was so much fun. At that time, my cousin Herman was still racing World Cup, so we traveled to the races together. He's 10 years older than me, so he was always like the role model, cool kid that I just wanted to be like. So I just remember like when I got into it and did my first World Cup, I traveled with him, and then we basically did the whole season together, like privateering. Type of thing, and yeah, it was really cool. You know, as a 17-year-old to go to all these sick places that you've seen in some movies, and yeah, it was good times.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, quite an eye-opening experience, I suppose, to be traveling around the world riding bikes at that age.
Yeah, and like when I did my first junior world champs in Livigno, I mean, I hadn't raced any downhill outside of Sweden. So I had like start number 89, and there was a Japanese guy who started in front of me on a Kona Stinky that I had to like pass. And like there was all these things in the beginning happening that like I really laugh about now. I didn't think it was that funny then.
Yeah, I bet.
But like afterwards, I've laughed about it many times. Like, I remember my first world champs. I started behind his, I don't know what his name was, but like he rode on a Kona Stinky and it didn't go super well for him.
No, that's full on.
Yeah, pretty full on. Fair play to him that he even made it down that track on a Stinky.
Yeah, good effort. How did you get on at that World Champs?
I think I crashed three times in my finals run, and I finished like 25th or something.
Okay.
In juniors.
Yeah, yeah.
So not too bad considering I think it was I was probably 10 from last, so like say it was 90-ish people participating, so
yeah, that's
not
right.
Too bad.
Yeah. So how was it being funded in those early days then? You said you were kind of privateer. Did you have any support?
From the beginning it was like you got some support from the federation, and then I was importing, I already started importing bikes to Sweden when I was 16.
Okay.
And we were selling a brand called The Bomb that I raced for quite a few years. And they kind of funded my first World Cup season. Like, it's not like I got a massive deal or anything, but they helped pay for it. So that was pretty amazing. Like, looking back at it, I didn't really have any results or anything, but they kind of backed it up a little bit, and yeah, it's just every penny counts, as everyone who's done it knows. So like a little bit here, a little bit there, and then yeah, we just made it happen, kind of. I've not to be cocky or anything, but I've always been pretty good at making those things happen somehow, in by all means necessary.
What led you to starting to import bikes age 16? That's quite young to be starting doing something like that.
Yeah, it was I was sort of be sponsored by a guy who was importing that brand to Sweden like a few years earlier, which was like, we got discount. They had a sick hardtail frame that I wanted, and then we got like a really good deal off him on it. And then he stopped, and then they came out with this downhill bike that I wanted. but there wasn't anyone selling it in Sweden. So then I remember I wrote to someone in Taiwan to ask like if we could buy it from them. And then they said, nah, you can't, like, you can't buy just one frame, but you can, we need a distributor if you're interested. And I was like, yeah, I'm just going to talk to mom. and then because my brother was also racing, so it wasn't that huge amount of like stuff to that you had to buy then to start selling it, so we kind of funded the start of it. We just bought the bikes we needed for our racing season, and then started selling it 1 year, and then it took off pretty good actually after the first year we had it. So eventually that was kind of my side job, or more like my job, and then riding was like my side gig, and then I went to school as well. But I had some pretty full-on years there, like 17 18 19.
Yeah, keeping yourself busy.
Yes.
And you, at some point, you put your own team together as well, didn't you? What led to that?
Yeah, to cut the long story short, it was like I signed in 2009. I raced for Sun through that started through the Swedish distributor of Sun bikes, and then the year after I signed for the Sun like factory team. Mm-hmm. With the dream of like, okay, now I'm just gonna focus on racing. I think they just started to go back to having like financial issues the year that I signed.
Okay.
And it got pretty obvious that things weren't that great, like towards middle of the season. And I was really just like frustrated of how things worked in the team, and I didn't really enjoy it. So I was like, screw this, I'm gonna do my own team next year. And it was a really weird situation because my brother was obviously also racing at the same time, and we always like traveled together, but then all of a sudden we went to the same races, but I went by myself and he went with some other Swedish crew or by himself. So it was kind of, I didn't think it through before I signed the deal with them. But then when I was like in the middle of it, I was like, yeah, this is not what we want to be doing, I think. So it was a little bit of both, like not just that I mean, the people in the team I really enjoyed hanging out with and so on, but it was just a weird setup for me. So then we just started our own team the next year.
Make it sound so simple.
It definitely wasn't simple, like it was a steep learning curve.
What sort of things did you learn along the way?
That things always cost a lot more money than you think.
Yeah.
And it always takes a lot more time than you think. But I was a bit optimistic in terms of like how easy it would be to manage a team and race. yourself in it for a while. Like, I think it's one thing to run your own personal program. I think that's easy compared to having... The first year, it was just me, Niklas, and a mechanic at the races. But the second year, we had a junior as well and one mechanic. So it was kind of, I worked on my bike and someone else's bike all the time, even at the World Cups. That was pretty stressful, actually.
And living out the back of a van, I guess, as well. You probably didn't have a massive a truck and all that kind of stuff in those days.
Yeah. We had a good setup, and I think things kind of worked pretty good, but like looking back at it, it was pretty crazy to think that you could like race and manage and mechanic and perform at like a World Cup level. It just doesn't add up.
Yeah, fair enough. So 2009, then, looking back, was probably your best season in World Cup downhill, would you say? Like, you broke into the top 20 at Fort William, and at one point you were, was it 21st in the overall, I think?
Yeah, that was definitely my most like consistent year anyway. Like you say, I've that year I was around the top 20 or in the top 20 almost every race that I finished. that was probably my best World Cup season.
And you weren't even due to race all the World Cups that year, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I did, because that was the year before I signed a deal with Sun. I had my own like privateer set up, but on a Sun frame. But I didn't really have any money to go to the US or like to the two rounds in Canada. But then, because I was 21st in the overall, I was like, okay, this has to happen. This is potentially my chance to like be top 20 or top, like my dream was to be top 15 in the overall that year. So I was like, okay, if I just go there and do what I've been doing, it's going to work. And I remember I sold some parts and some old bikes to like pay for the ticket to go.
Yeah.
And I went, and it went straight to hell.
What happened?
I had a flat tire in qualifying in Mont Saint-Anne after maybe 1 minute at the top there. So I scored 0 points there, and I was 21st. So like the top 20 are protected World Cup.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I was like one spot from being protected, but then, yeah, so 0 points there. And then the weekend after, I just sucked. but then I was just so scared to do the same thing over again. So I didn't qualify very good, but I qualified, and I was like, oh, okay, let's race now. I think I was like 40th or something in qualifying. And then in the race, I went pretty far above the limit, and then ended up crashing and scored. I think I finished like 50 at something and scored like 2 points. I remember I was like, when we were driving back to the airport after Bromont, I was like, okay, I could have saved a lot of money here and just stayed at home. But then I was like, but it was still a good trip.
That's all good. Yeah. And the following year, you were European champ in Hafil. That's pretty good. You got to be happy with that.
Yeah, that was probably, yeah, one of the happier days on a downhill bike for me. That was a pretty special place to win it as well, because it felt kind of like a home race. It's just 4 hours from where I used to live, so it was pretty special. Yeah,
excellent. And then obviously you carried on with your World Cup career, probably never quite got back to sort of 2009, sort of seemed to be a bit of a peak for you. And then 2014, end of the season, you turned up at Finale Ligure and had a go at, I think that was your first Enduro World Series round. Is that right?
Yeah. So
what took you there? Was it just for a bit of fun? Like, quite a lot of teams seem to go there at the end of the season, and you see a lot more downhillers turn up.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Quite early on, I had already decided that, okay, this is going to be my last year of racing. I'm going to quit after this year, because World Champs was in Hafjell in Norway. And it was just like, I was pretty over going to the World Cups. And I was like, okay, we're done. We're not going to go any further with the team as it is. So I was like, okay, I'm going to just step back from this and see. I was never going to give up bikes, but I was like ready to give up racing World Cups, and that was all that I was really, really interested in at that time. So I was like, mm-hmm. Okay, this is it. But then I had done some Swedish enduros, and I really remember thinking, like, each one I did, I was like, okay, this would have been really sick if it was some, like, if we rode some good trails, but they never had any good trails. So I think it was when we were in Mont Saint-Anne that year, I emailed Chris at EWS to see, like, hey, could there potentially be any spots left to race in Finale? Because that was like the only round that I could potentially do. And he said no. So I was like, oh shit, because I was really keen on like trying one or maybe two rounds that year, and then see if it would be nice to race next year or I don't know what the hell I was thinking, but I was keen on trying it anyway. But then he said no, and I was like, oh shit, okay, maybe. No, I remember I thought, okay, no more racing ever then, huh? Yeah. And then I think it was when we were just rolling into Hafjell for World Champs, he got back to me and like, hey, would you still be interested in racing in Italy? We have a few people that was injured or whatever, like they had a few spots all of a sudden. I was like, hell yeah, I'm going. But we didn't really have any, like, I didn't have any budget left for the team. We didn't have really any money. But then, that trip just came together in like one evening, because I used to do the IXS, like the European Cup in downhill, and they had like one race left in the series that we had just like scrapped off our team schedule because we didn't have any money to go there. And that was in Leogang. And then the following weekend, there was a European Cup in Enduro in Germany somewhere. So I was like, okay, if I go and I make sure I get on the podium at both races, it's going to work out financially, otherwise I'm screwed.
You needed the bonuses from the podium places, right?
I needed I don't know how many, it was maybe a couple hundred euros to win each race, but I was like, yeah, I have to get the prize money to like be able to fill up the car to go home. That was basically the status of Team Walner Bros Racing. So I did, and it worked out pretty well. And then I came to Finale, and I just loved it from like the first day. And it's like, it, how anyone that's been to Finale knows that it's impossible to not like it there.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So it was probably a pretty good place to start it off at. And it went pretty well, like really well actually. But mainly I just really enjoyed it, and I was like, oh, this is what I should have been doing the last 2 years. That was it really.
yeah. So where do you go from there then? Because you didn't do a full EWS series in 2015, did you?
No, and I was a little bit torn if I was really going to like fully get into racing that full time or not. So I had actually a few like offers to race the year after, like no salary, but to race all races with like all expenses paid. But I was like, nah, I'm not going to do it because I wasn't sure if I was ready for it. And I wasn't sure if I was going to like enjoy a full season of it. So I was like, I decided pretty early on that I just made a small like privateer program by myself and did a few races to see what it was like real to do not a full season, but pretty much like I did all the European rounds and then I did the race in Whistler. And that was it for that year. Cause I worked quite a bit at home that year as well. And I just wanted to sort of try my hand at it without investing too much feelings into it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And it obviously worked. You enjoyed it enough to want to commit and go further, because 2016 was, I think, your first full year, and it was when you signed with Ibis as well, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. Like at the end of 2015, they had just hired a new girl to manage the team the following year, and she got in touch with me pretty early on, like after I think after the race in Whistler even, and we started talking. But it was pretty funny because I know at least like four other riders that she was talking to at the same time. And I remember me and Matti Laikkonen were staying in the same hotel room in Ainsa in Spain that year, and she was talking to him as well about like the following year. It was just a funny situation where you're like, yeah, okay, so how much would you be willing to ride for, and blah blah blah. I wasn't sure that I was going to get the ride or whatever until pretty late, but I'm really happy with how it worked out in the end.
We've been with them a long time now, so it's obviously a good partnership.
Yeah, it feels like a bit of a family relationship almost, to be honest, because they've grown quite a lot since I started writing for them. But it's when you go there, you know almost everyone who works there. Now every time there's new people and new staff, obviously, but like the main people are still there, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, good stuff. What do you think made you good at enduro then?
I've thought about that too a few times. No, but honestly, I think because I did all disciplines, and I've been fairly skillful no matter what type of bike pretty much my whole career. Like I wasn't like really at the top in downhill, I wasn't at the top in four cross or whatever. I raced a little bit of XC, I did almost everything. And I think that will make you pretty good at enduro, because it's about being all round on the bike. And then I think just experience, really, that you learn how to sort of read the terrain and how to manage a race like that by riding a lot. But I mean, somehow there's people like Martin Mays who are just good at it from the age 15. But I think experience definitely helps.
With reading all the different types of terrain and stuff as well, I suppose riding in a lot of different places must help.
Yeah, exactly. And then I mean, I think there's a lot of really good downhill racers that don't really do that well at enduro, because it's pretty it's pretty different to just ride the stage once and then race it. Like you don't remember everything. There's no way that you can remember everything. Whereas in downhill, you know almost every single rock, you know exactly every line that you're gonna hit in your run. But with enduro, you can't. Like there's no way that I'm sure there's maybe someone who can, but I can't do it. It's more of a like you improvise and you just make sure you read the terrain, and then there's obviously key sections that you have to remember, but I never like there's no way that I can remember everything. So it's more like you go by feel, and that's pretty different to downhill racing. But that's also what keeps me sort of interested and like motivated, that it's never the same. Like you go back somewhere, but it's never you race this. Maybe one stage could be the same as the year before, but it's always something new, and it just keeps it so exciting all the time. That's why it's so addictive and I can't really stop.
Do you use your GoPro much to help with trying to remember bits of stages, or are you a rider that uses feel and intuition a bit more?
I definitely use the GoPro, and I've started making notes, and I felt like that helped me a lot to like remember the most important stuff on each stage. I don't go too crazy on GoProing, and like I watch it once and make notes, and then I'm done with it. But I know, I mean, there's some guys who they don't walk any stages, they don't watch any GoPro footage, and they still kill it. So, but I feel like that's everyone has a different process before the races, and that's kind of part of my process. But like the first 2 years that I raced, I didn't even have a GoPro. I just went by feel. And then there's some races that I've done, like last year, that I didn't have time to watch any of my GoPro footage before the race, and so on, and it was like my best race of the season. Okay. So it's like sometimes you do what you think is the right thing to do, and that's probably good for your like mental process, but I'm not so sure that it always helps.
Okay, interesting. What sort of notes might you make then? Can you give us an example of the sort of things that you might write down?
Actually, I looked in my notebook just last week, and it had tons of like, okay, big tree on your right, then sharp left. Just okay. Cause like that's the typical like, or that you go on to like gravel road, second branch on your left, then turn off. Cause that's the typical place where you forget that. Like you know that you're gonna look for a turn off that they've taped, but it always comes up a lot quicker when you're racing than in practice. So it's so like the typical thing where you could like end up missing it and lose a lot of time. So that's maybe one of the like main things that I write down, like something to look for where there is a turn off, or something to look for before. Like a sketchy section where I need to be. Mm-hmm. Like in the section, I already know where I need to be, but then I just want to know when it's coming up.
Okay.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. 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 So it went pretty good. 2016, 2017, solid set of results, but it seems like 2018 is when it kind of really all started to click into place for you, and the results really started to come. Did you do anything different in that 2017 to 2018 off season? Was your preparation any different? Like,
Yeah, I did. And then I think it started to really click in 17 as well, but I just didn't. Like when I finished fourth in Whistler, I think there was a few races before where I also had like that kind of podium speed, but it just didn't quite work out. Mm-hmm. And then that off season we spent in Finale. Well, not all of it, but I spent like a solid month in Finale before the season, and that made a pretty big difference in terms of like going to the first race and feeling a bit more prepared and like mentally a bit more relaxed. But then also the fact that in some way it affected me really well for my racing that we were having a child, because I was just like, I didn't really care. like I obviously cared about the racing and I was there to give my 100%, but I felt like it didn't matter so much. Then it just worked. it's funny how it like mentally, it's almost easier mentally when you're not too heavily involved, emotionally involved in your racing, or at least for me, because I was like, okay, this might be my last, like every race I went to, I felt like this could be the last opportunity this year. I'm just going to give it my 100% and then we'll see how it goes. And I didn't even think about points and results at the beginning of the year, or even mid-season. I didn't think much about it because I knew what the story was going to sort of be, and that I was going to miss some races, and I just wanted to do as good as I possibly could at the races that I could do, and then yeah, it just worked.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it worked straight away. Chile, first round of the year, third place, your first podium in EWS. Must have felt pretty good.
Yeah, it felt really amazingly well. especially, I really remember like heading into day two of racing. It was like me and Jesse Melamed, and then like the second to last stage, I had a crash and gave away like 10 seconds or something to him on that stage. And then I remember thinking that, oh shit, another fourth place. And then I went up like with the chairlift to the last stage, thinking like, okay, but anything can happen on the last stage. And then he started in front of me. And I started seeing him quite early on the stage. So I was like, something is wrong here. And then he had a flat tire. So I knew pretty early on that I was going to be on the podium if I could just fucking make it down the stage. So yeah, that was a pretty special moment. It was kind of, I would have rather have him not flat and just beat him straight up on the stage, but I was incredibly happy. Like I couldn't even believe it when I crossed the line that it finally happened, sort of thing.
Yeah, it must be quite emotional because there's a lot of years of work that go into that, and then to think it's almost been taken away from you and then get it back on the final stage.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was like in tears when I just finished, because I was really, yeah, I mean, everyone is always like, you're so drained at the end of a race, but I was just emotionally kind of drained that like, oh my God, it actually happened. I can't realize it's happening. So yeah, that was pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, and you backed it up. So I think sixth in Manizales the following weekend, and then ninth in Alag and third in Pets and Jamnica, which left you sitting second in the overall in the 2018 season. And like you said, you know, you always knew that you were going to have to miss some rounds for the birth of your son. Was there ever a question over that? And what was it like being at home while everyone else was in Le Twil, knowing that you're letting that second place in the overall go effectively?
There wasn't really any question that I was like just going to go anyway, even though there was a lot of questions from other people and like co-sponsors to the team and all this and that. People that usually I've never spoken to before all of a sudden got involved and like, but you realize you really need to be there, right? And I was like, no, I don't need to be there. If if that's the case, then yeah, just fuck off. but yeah, it was, of course, it was a weird situation because when they raced in Latwil, he wasn't born yet. He was born on the Monday that week, I think. So I was like fully healthy. I was training at home, and I remember when they did day two of racing, I was just on a long ride, but close enough to the car that I could pull out of the ride each lap and just go to the hospital whenever we needed. But on every transfer like pedal section up, I was like scrolling through the results sheet to see what the damage was. But it was like, of course I was like bummed, but and I tried not to care, but of course I cared. Like it would have been amazing to be there as well, but it wasn't an alternative really.
And I'm guessing you'll never regret that decision.
No, but I mean, when I get really old, I can always like tell Ted that, yeah, you know, this one year I could have done this, but then you.
Awesome. No. Yeah, you can't miss that, can you? You can't miss the birth of your first child.
No, there's no. I at least in my opinion, I don't think there's any racing that will sort of replace that feeling.
Yeah, good stuff. And so you came back, I think, was it Whistler your first race back after Ted was born?
Yeah, that was actually the week after.
Okay.
And that was one of the hardest decisions I've made ever to go, because he was only, like, we were still in the hospital when I had to like decide if, okay, should we book a ticket or what should we do? And then Elin just told me that you like, it's gonna be fine, you just go. So I did, but I didn't really fully make my mind up until I was like at the airport that I was going to get on the plane, because it felt, yeah, I mean, it didn't feel great to just leave them after like 5 days. So yeah, it was kind of that was a hard race to come back to for me.
Did it put more pressure on you for a result if you're traveling to the other side of the world in that situation?
Yeah, definitely. That was probably the first time that year that I really felt a lot of pressure, mostly from myself, that I cannot screw this up and just go to Whistler for 10 days out of Ted's first weeks alive and like have a flat tire or crash and not even finish the race. Then I would have been pretty sad. Yeah. And I remember the first thing that happened in the race was I crashed on stage one, dropped my water bottle as well. And I was like, oh no, this is not good. And then I kind of put it together good enough to, I think I was like eighth or ninth in the end.
Eighth, but, yeah. Eighth in the end, yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty... it was a weird race for me, and a weird, like, yeah, a super weird trip. And I flew in really late, so I was so drained going. Yeah, you just had a baby, so you know, the first weeks, it's not like an easy gig at home.
No, for sure.
And like zero sleep. And then I just jumped on the plane to go to Worcester. And then I was super jet lagged still for race day. I wasn't feeling great in the morning. And then Worcester is like always one of the biggest days of the season. So I was really happy to get out of there like alive and with some points and like, okay, I can still ride a bike. Let's go back and and start this over again.
So how would you say being a dad has affected you and your racing then? Because it's however hard you try, it's clearly going to change things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in some ways it's affected me in like there's always good and not great things, but I really enjoy going to the races a lot more because I feel like it's kind of really my time. Mm-hmm. If that makes like it's my job, but then it's also like my I really value that time away from home, if that makes sense. But then, I mean, it's obviously racing is a 24/7 process, like at the races and at home. So, and it's hard to have that process going on all the time when you have a kid at home. Overall, I think it's amazing, but it's definitely like last year was really. Pretty hard work at home because we had a lot of issues with sleep and I didn't sleep much when I was at home, and then yeah. You always try to sort of make up for not being at home, so I was pretty drained during last season actually. So it's not been I feel like now we're in a really good state at home, but last year was really, really hard actually.
Yeah, recovery and sleep is a big part of training, isn't it?
It is.
It's probably it's like, the most important part.
It's what I tell everyone who ask, people like to ask, like, how do you train? How many hours and this and that? And I always answer like, yeah, I don't do that much more than you can do when you work full time, but the recovery is the most important part. But then it's so easy to say that, but then I'm not a great example of of optimizing your recovery because sleep is pretty key ingredient to recover. I found out.
Oh, well, it's all learning, isn't it?
Yeah it is.
So how was your preparation for the 2020 season then? So it sounds like sleep's been a bit better.
Yeah, I mean, sleep's been better. And we spent a bit of time in Italy this off season as well because Elin was able to get some time off work. So we had, I spent again like a month in Italy before the season was going to start, just when Corona sort of went crazy down there. So that was like I had a really good off season, I felt like, whereas before last year I didn't really feel that prepared before going to New Zealand. But this year I felt like, we had a good winter behind us. So, but then, it's who knows
on hold.
Yeah
And I've seen in some photos you guys have been using the I think it's the Motion Instruments data acquisition system.
Yeah,
I was interested to know how you've been getting on with that and how you found it's helped you with bike setup.
We started using it a little bit the year before, but I didn't have one at home until like this off season. And then it's always hard to sort of, when you're not used to using it frequently, it's hard to know what to look for. But now I feel like I kind of know what numbers I want to get out of it and what I personally need to look for to get mm-hmm. the feeling I want. So I think it definitely helped a bit to sort of pinpoint what's good and what's not good and what works and what doesn't really work. But then at mm-hmm. the end of the day, for enduro, it's so much down to feel as well, because
yeah.
it doesn't matter if your bike is perfectly set up on paper and in the computer. When you go out and race for like 20 minutes or like 10 to 15 minutes, you need to set it up the way you feel comfortable on. Because I mean, I could set my suspension up really stiff and to handle going through a rough section perfectly, but then I'm not going to be able to hold on to it for 15 minutes. So it's like always a balance between what's good and what feels good. It has to sort of be a bit of both. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely helped to sort of have something to really look at and to help me, you know, what to look for, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And you ride your bike, or you set your bike up really soft and fast. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And is yeah. that, do you think it's unusually soft compared to other EWS riders?
Yeah, a little bit compared to some. I know, like, just as an example, like Greg probably has his bike pretty soft as well, but I'm usually like 20 PSI lower than like Lewis, who was on the team, Lewis Buchanan, who was on the team before. His bike was always like 20 PSI more pressure in the shock than me, and so yeah, I think it's a bit unusually soft.
Okay,
yeah.
Why do you think you've ended up with a setup like that?
I think because I always have to argue with Jordi about this as well. So I've gotten really good at defending myself. No, first of all, I have really long legs, and I think that's made me ride a lot. Like my upper body always ends up pretty far up front on the bike. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of, because my bike is pretty unbalanced as well. If you just like, if you look at the motion instrument stuff, it's balanced, but if you just sit on it, if someone else sits on it, it's not balanced like in the parking lot.
Okay.
So that probably has a bit to do with it, and then just riding style, because I really value that like confidence feel of good traction, mm-hmm. and that usually means softer and faster for the wheel to be able to track the ground. But then I think the fast rebound settings also comes into play because it's a soft setup. If I ran slower rebound, I think the bike would pack in pretty quickly.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. So is the lack of balance, is that because your body shape is different, you think, from other people, so you've got more weight over the front of the bike maybe?
Maybe I think not just like body shape, but maybe riding style. I think someone okay. who would ride a bit more central or a bit more in the rear than me would definitely struggle to ride my bike.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a complex topic, that one. One that I've never quite got the hang of, but
yeah,
I'll keep looking.
I mean, it's such a personal thing too, but I feel like I tried to change it as well, but I'm 32. It's really hard to change when you get old.
yeah, I know that feeling.
Yeah.
Fair play. So the arguments with Geordie continue then?
No, we don't really argue. He's actually really supportive sometimes nowadays. yeah.
Excellent. So I was thinking a little bit about team setups, because you guys seem to have a pretty good vibe with what you're doing. And in downhill, the team setup, it seems to be a really important part of a rider's success. And it also seems to need to suit that specific rider. Every team's different. They fit, different riders fit better in different teams. Do you think it's similar for Enduro? Because the team kind of infrastructure that travels to the races, it's not as big. But do you think it's important, like, who you're with at the event?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I don't think I wouldn't have been riding for Ibis if I didn't enjoy the team setup we have. Then I don't think I would have been around that long. So, definitely is important. And, I mean, even if it's a smaller structure that you travel with, you still travel with the people for big periods of time during the year and mostly during the summer. So I think if you didn't enjoy hanging out with the people around you, and you didn't, like, if you don't trust the mechanic you have and enjoy hanging out with the people in the team, it's not going to be a good setup for you. And I feel like I really enjoy working with all the people that we have in the team right now. Yeah.
And you seem to have fun.
Yeah. And like all the people that's been on the team during my years, I've enjoyed working with everyone.
Yeah. And you've become the team dad.
Yeah. a little bit. Like, it's just come as a natural thing. And Bex just calls me dad all the time. It's pretty funny, actually. But yeah. And I mean, it's maybe both due to me being the oldest one on the team, and then the fact that I've been there for 5 years now. But I'm fine with dad.
Good stuff. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time, but we've got our four questions that we've asked pretty much everyone, so we'll hit those up.
Yeah.
The first of those, if our listeners had £150, which I think is about 1,700 Swedish krona, to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
Ooh, tires.
Okay. What's your go-to?
My go-to tires. Minion DHF front, cut down aggressor in the rear. Check out my Instagram to see how I cut them.
Yeah, so I had a look at this actually. You're cutting one of the middle knobs out for extra braking traction, is that right?
Yeah. It's actually
because they've got that kind of consistent, almost consistent central element to make them roll faster.
Yeah.
And you're cutting into that.
Yeah, and it's actually made a pretty big difference to them. So yeah, that would be my pro tip of the day.
I've not seen any other EWS people on Maxxis running the aggressor. Is that quite unusual?
I mean, I run it as my sort of go-to tire for like pedaling. And then at the races, I'll run them if it's a place not in the Alps, so to speak. I mean, I ran them in Finale last year, for example, because I feel like they're the rolling resistance is really nice with them, but then they're maybe not the best option if you're going to go to a place that has chairlift. Then you might as well just run a double DHF combo or something a bit more sturdy. But I quite like to have a fast rolling rear tire.
Yeah. And you go in with the DH casing?
Yeah. The aggressor you can only get with the double down casing.
Okay.
If you run 29ers, it's like 100 gram difference, so it's still a sturdy tire.
Yeah, got you. Okay, good stuff. Second one, if you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
Take it easy, man.
And why do you say that?
because if I wind the clock back to myself that long ago, I think I tried to do everything, and I've learned that you can't be good at everything.
True.
Yeah, that's probably the advice I would give.
And were you crashing your brains out as well at that age?
Yeah, I was. I was a pretty big time free rider at that time as well. Yeah, I crashed a lot then.
But you got away with all of it then.
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm pretty healthy. Yeah. So, yeah.
Cool. Not carrying too many aches and pains from old crashes.
No, not too many, but we'll see. Ask me again in 10 years.
All right. Third question. If you could have a coaching session from anybody, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Ooh, this is a really hard choice. I'm going to say Bulios. I would want to go and have him teach me how to ride the switchbacks in Cap Dai. Or just any switchbacks. I mean, a coaching session from him would be pretty mint.
Definitely. Yeah, I'd be in on that one. All right, final question. What do you do every day that you feel benefits you?
Every day. Right now, I rehab my shoulder every day, and it benefits me really well.
Okay.
So that's probably the thing I do now every day. Yeah.
Have you had a dislocation or something with it? Or
yeah, I had some issues with that, and then I also broke my shoulder blade. That was actually the off season before 2018. And then I never really dealt with it like properly. Should have had surgery on it then, but didn't. Yeah, it's just sort of it comes back at you sooner or later. So I've tried to use this time that we all had now to actually really work on it. So I try to do that every day, and I feel like it's really been helping. So yeah, hopefully gonna be healthy as ever whenever we get to start racing again.
Yeah, yeah. When is the, I can't remember when the latest EWS calendar is supposed to start. It's the back end of the year, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're meant to start 29th of August in Zermatt. And then if things go to plan, we race all the way until the second week of November. So it's going to be a pretty busy fall.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully it happens. It'd be great to see some racing. If people want to follow you, where's the best place for them to look?
Instagram, at my Robin_Wallner page. That's pretty much the only place I put anything up.
Okay, and there's some the vlog stuff over on YouTube.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and then there's a YouTube channel. If you go and click the link in my Instagram, you'll find a YouTube channel for that. So yeah, try and follow up there.
Nice one. Yeah, we'll put some links in the show notes so that people can find that.
Cool.
Nice one. Well, it's been super interesting chatting, and fingers crossed that we get some 2020 enduro racing on the go soon. And I hope it goes well for you, man.
Yeah, I hope so too. Thanks for having me. It's been an honor.
Nice one. Thanks, Robin.
Cheers.
All right, that's it for this episode with Robin. I hope you've enjoyed listening. Massive thank you to Leia and Nukeproof for supporting this episode. This podcast would no longer exist without the support of the awesome brands and listeners who help me keep this thing going, so I really do appreciate it. Don't forget to head over to layat.com and check out their awesome range of products. And if you want to be in with a chance of winning a pair of their new Aaron Chase signature shoes, then head to layat.com/ACshoe and get entered before the end of July. Also, head over to nukeproof.com and check out their entire range. If you want to be in with a chance of winning a set of their new Horizon wheels, then you just need to head to downtimepodcast.com/nukeproof and answer the really easy question. It even tells you where to go and find the answer. All the links are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Don't forget to check out all the new t-shirts over at downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support the podcast at the same time. If you've got time, head over and leave us a review wherever it is you listen to the podcast. It's much appreciated. It's great to hear your thoughts, and it helps other people find the podcast too. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Please keep on spreading the word. You can do that by telling your friends, by sharing our episodes in whatever way works best for you. The more people that listen, the easier it gets for me to keep this thing going. So spreading the word really does help make sure the podcast stays on air. All right, there's another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, look after each other. And if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride.